Thank you very much, Lisa. As Lisa said, we met when I did a previous session for Future of London, and my secretary had said to me that I just didn't have the time to do these things anymore, so she was just going to do a blanket no when I was asked. But when she saw that this was about Thames Water and Transport for London and everybody digging up, given our recent experiences, she knew that I just wouldn't be able to resist. So what I have to do is pull my horns in a bit and just act as a very nice chair. We have three really good speakers, and we have three very clear questions. We're going to take the questions in the order that we thought was the most logical, rather than the how they appear on the agenda. We have Tim Chapman, who's Director of Infrastructure Design Group for AREP. We have Mel Gardner, who's a Technical Director, Rails and Tunnels Limited. And we have Chris Porter from TfL. We're going to start with the question, what's the greatest threat lurking underground? Putting that into the context of just how difficult and challenging it is to try to improve and work on the infrastructure of a city as ancient and as complicated as London. We'll then move on to the piece that really, really interests and concerns me, which is how do you balance the greater good with local impact? And then to round that off, what will it take to make above underground projects ran better? So hopefully we'll be putting it into context, we'll be saying what the challenges are, and hopefully our panel have some views as to how they're going to make things better in the future. So we're going to go straight on to Mel, who's going to concentrate on what's the greatest threat lurking underground. Mel, over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Well, what is lurking underground? Well, I've been lurking underground for a long time myself, but most people probably don't realize just how much is underneath their feet as they walk down the street. You may see the odd manhole cover that suggests, yes, there's something down there, but there's a lot more than that. Also, you all use the underground every day, so you know that's under there, but there's lots and lots of other things that are there, and there are other things that are not man-made that have an impact as well. If we deal with the underground first, the first underground followed the streets. The first section, the Metropolitan Line, later the District Line, they just dug up the street, built the railway in it, and then covered it over again. That's probably not too much of a problem for people with making future developments because it's under the streets. Even the earlier tube tunnels followed the streets. That was to avoid claims from property owners for settlement. It was not until the 1930s that the underground started striking out and actually going under buildings. And that the first was a section between Liverpool Street and Bethnal Green on the extension of the Central Line. You can actually, when you ride on some of the older tube tunnels, detect almost the layout of the street above. Or maybe it's only me that does that. But more recent underground developments since the Second World War, like the Victoria Line, the Jubilee Line, and now Crossrail, just take the shortest distance from A to B. Not quite. They do have to take some deviation to avoid other obstacles underground, but it does mean that it may well be, if you want to develop a site, that beneath you is an underground structure, like a railway tunnel. And London Underground has a requirement that you don't build anything within 3 metres of either side of their tunnels or 6 metres above. And that actually blights quite a large strip of land along the alignment of the underground railways. And that for any future developments, that's always going to be a problem. There's also a problem that if you start digging deep excavations, and I'm sure Tim will cover this better, that London is, the ground in London is over consolidated, and if you take a deep excavation down on top of another structure, the ground will start to heave, and any structures below will be affected. This happened when the Shell Centre was built in the 1950s on the South Bank, and also with the British Library. In Euston Road, there were problems with the Victoria Line and the Northern Line below the British Library. And so there are opportunities, however, for developments on some sections of the underground, particularly the older open sections and the subsurface section. There's been some already. Barbican's a good example. It's over the Metropolitan Line. Mansion House, it was built over the District Line. And Moorgate has also had developments built over the top of it. There's plenty of other opportunities. I was in discussions recently with people at London Underground telling me they're looking at Whitechapel for an overstation development, and there's probably people here from Tower Hamlets that know about that. But there are other places. South Kensington, people have been trying to build a development over it since the 1980s and even put some foundations in. So there's plenty of scope for development over some of the open sections of the subsurface underground. But what else is there? We've already had mention of the plague pits. Places like Charterhouse Square, and in Westminster there's Vincent Square. Just down the road here there's a patch of land between Houndsditch and Devonshire Square that's a plague pit. But others have been built over already, and so that a new development could be a problem. New Street, just down the road here, there were plague pits in the area there. There were some over in the Smithfield and Spitalfields area. So they will be a problem for any developments. There are other obstructions as well, like sewers. We talked about already about lost rivers. There are cable tunnels all over the place, particularly in this area, because there is lots of communication needs in the city. And British Telecom have got lots and lots of tunnels in this area. And Crossrail alignment has to take those into account, and future developments will. They're not all under the streets. There are cable tunnels for electricity. There's the Post Office Railway that some of you may know about. It's not used anymore, but the tunnels are still there. They run all the way from Paddington to Whitechapel, and they don't follow the streets either. They're under property. And then there are some tunnels which people don't talk about. It's happened to me in my career where I've been told, well, you need to move your tunnel alignment, but they won't tell me where I can move it to. Because particularly in Westminster, around Parliament Square, and in the Whitehall area, there are tunnels which ordinary mortals don't know about. There are geological issues as well, and Tim's going to talk more on that. Finally, there's archaeology. London's full of archaeology. You can't just go digging holes willy-nilly all over the place. It's going to affect archaeology almost certainly. And every site now, once it's opened up, the Museum of London come in, and we've had lots of visits from them on the Crossrail project. And it's good to see them. I personally, I know it delays the job quite often, I don't want to destroy the heritage. And the final thing that needs to be considered is quite poignant today is flooding. London Underground and Crossrail have been very careful with the way they've designed their stations to prevent flooding, not necessarily from the Thames. We know at the moment there's serious flooding not far from here because of a burst water main, and that's generally what's caused this flooding, water mains. This recent past, of course, has been flooding from the Thames further west in London, but that is not a normal occurrence in the centre of town. So I'll hand over to my colleagues now, who are going to pick holes in what I've just said and hopefully expand on it a bit.
So that puts it into the context of what's lying underneath there. What's really interesting about virtually all of the underground projects is that people want the outcome. They want the project. The project improves the city, but they don't actually like the impact, and sometimes the impact can be pretty intolerable and over an extended period of time. So Tim, putting it into that context, that we know that it's problematic, and that's what makes these construction projects so big, so difficult, and so long-lasting, Could you go across the three questions that have been posed from your perspective?
Thanks, Eleanor, and thanks, Mel, for a very, very good introduction for some of the interesting things lurking under London. I think Eleanor's challenge is a very good one, because on infrastructure, there's always a great dichotomy between the people who receive the benefits and the people who receive the impacts. And on small infrastructure, like maybe mobile phone masts or mini roundabouts, hopefully the two people who both suffer and gain are the same. But for very big infrastructure, often the losers lose a lot, and there's lots and lots of winners, all of whom win a bit, and the cumulative win for society is huge. But for these people, it is actually a very, very big impact. It's a threat to their homes, a threat to their families, it's a threat to their livelihood. And the critical thing is trying to balance these things out for society, because we all gain from infrastructure. Infrastructure is the lifeblood that makes us civilized. Without the things that, the sort of the light that comes on in this room, the sewers, the water that comes here, the transport to enable us to come here reasonably easily, we couldn't survive in a very, very big city like London. So the trickier thing is how to balance these very small number of losers who lose a lot against a very, very large number of winners who might win something in 10 years' time. Mel and I both worked in Crossrail in 1991-92, and we're very pleased to see it finally happening in 2018. For those of you who are better at maths, there's a bit of a gap between those two numbers, and the people who were going to have this imposition put on them knew very strongly that they did not want to have a station here, did not want a shaft here, didn't want a TBM worksite here for 5 or 6 years. And the people who are going to benefit from it in 2018, probably many of them weren't born at the time they were having these arguments and discussions. So they weren't around to argue their part in the future of society. It's also great when you see infrastructure that's created with a longevity. I mean, Bazalgette and the Great Sewer after the Great Stink in the 1850s is a really, really good place where Bazalgette sewers survived through London growing, doubling or tripling in size, and for 150 years. So it's a magnificent piece of civil engineering with a great amount of vision. You could also say the M1 was built at 6 lanes wide, and there was very, very few cars on it in the early days, but now any of you who have the misfortune to travel on it know that it's actually far too small. But again, the vision to turn it into build a 6-lane motorway, not a 4-lane motorway, which would have been more than adequate at the time, was visionary. I came across a quote about the West Coast Main Line. We're talking about High Speed 2 at the moment as another big impact on London. And in the 1833 bill to allow the start of the West Coast Main Line, the London to Birmingham Railway, get built, it was rejected first time around in Parliament in 1832, the argument being that the canals were more than sufficient for long-distance trade. There was no need to have one of these newfangled railways. And we possibly might disagree with that conclusion nowadays. I think the EIA process is the way that a lot of these things get regulated, and I don't personally believe it's very good for large infrastructure. It's very much a sort of set-piece process-driven procedure. There's consultation in it, but the consultation often doesn't feel to the locals like they're being consulted. It's very much a set-piece affair that professionals do, and a very vocal minority tend to often hijack slightly. EIA, the principles are really good. I think the execution could do with a little bit more thought about making it much more responsive to the needs of local people and making sure that they can buy into things. I also think for big infrastructure, we need more decisive processes. When we as a nation decide we want to do something, very often it takes an act of Parliament to make something like Crossrail happen. And wouldn't it be good, and maybe the Infrastructure Planning Commission will achieve this, if we could actually try and make infrastructure happen in a way that's much more consensual and much easier to actually happen, but certainly avoid decade-long inquiries, which again don't do anything apart from make possibly a few lawyers very, very rich. It'd also, I think, be very good to have a national strategy for infrastructure. The UK has been developed its infrastructure in very much a piecemeal way when I argue about Crossrail Line 2, but at least now there's a bit of a vision for how London might unfold. Very often in the UK, we tend to let congestion build up and then we respond to it, rather than having a proper decisive plan of what we intend to do as a nation, and let people vote on that in a proper way, either in a referendum or via national parliament. I don't know if any of you followed, but a guy called John Armitt, who helped create the Olympics, created a commission talking about bringing a new way of creating infrastructure, an infrastructure planning commission. Unfortunately, it's become politicized, but again, some form of arranging for the nation to try and think outside the electoral cycle. We have an election every 5 years, but planning big infrastructure takes 50 years often from the first idea, or even longer, through to it happening. So I think there's some interesting things about how to make sure, picking up the challenge from Eleanor about balancing the greater good against the small number of people who are often ridden roughshod over when some of these things take place. And we need to be better at that, I think, as a society. Mel spoke about Crossrail. Again, I've been very involved in Crossrail Line 1 for the whole length, and the tunnels weave their way through 42 other major tunnels along the route. I think that's quite phenomenal. No other city on the planet would have a new railway weaving its way through 42 other tunnels, never mind all the other utilities and foundations and everything else. And Crossrail 2 has got a bigger problem trying to get its way through those. Like Mel, I'm actually a geotechnical engineer at heart, so I'm very familiar with this. And actually, if I had longer, you'd have a complete lecture on this. But the key thing is, when we do a ground investigation, even a very, very thorough ground investigation, over 99.97% of the soil is not seen. So as a geotechnical engineer, I usually assume some form of X-ray spectacles to try and actually extrapolate from the 0.03% of the soil I see on a site to the 99.97. So there's lots of things lurking underground which cause consternation, some of which can be known about, and other fit into the Donald Rumsfeld unknown unknowns, which mean we don't find about out until they're too late. And then using Mel's sort of split, we split things between effectively geology, which is either God-made or nature-made, depending on how you feel, or man-made. And there's lots of man-made things underground. There's utilities and railways, some of which are valuable, some of which have actually been abandoned, but we don't know whether they're useful or not. We've got obstructions, some of which are really, really good, like foundations for buildings, and abandoned foundations and abandoned basements and other big lumps which actually confuse things. And we've got contamination, either chemical hazard or, dare I say, archaeology is a form of contamination, only in the sense of actually destroying how sites are taken forward. But certainly it's something which needs to be thought about, and I agree with Mel's point about valuing our heritage properly. And again, when you go to southern Europe, you see fantastic amounts of history around cities. London actually doesn't have that much to remind itself, so there is an important need to remind ourselves of the 2,000-year history of London. In terms of the final challenge, how do we make things better? I was very involved in the Infrastructure Carbon Review, which was a very interesting thing, trying to make sure that we create low carbon infrastructure rather than just infrastructure per se, and how we can make infrastructure more intelligently. And it came up with three very important challenges, which I think actually apply to all major projects. One is leadership. Too often projects are not well led, and we need to find a way, especially on big infrastructure, of making sure that these things happen better. The Olympics was a really good example of something with a very, very hard end date. On many other projects, end dates slip a little bit, sometimes in ways you notice, sometimes in ways you don't notice. But within Olympics, it's a very, very hard end date, so therefore, very good leadership was required and brought to bear. The second one is procurement methods. Often on big projects, procurement methods become a means unto themselves and actually distract from the fundamental project aims. And I think much more needs to be done to make sure procurement relates much more to what's trying to be created and for the fundamental outcomes that are required. A third challenge is on innovation. Major projects need to innovate. Serial clients for infrastructure need to appreciate that things will keep on getting more and more expensive if they don't innovate. And innovation requires bravery and it requires investment. And if we don't do that on our major projects, I think we as an industry don't advance quickly enough. But more fundamentally, we don't create projects that can be made cheaper and cheaper time and time again. And the final point I'm going to bring in is design. Good design is very clear when you see it. Bad design is also very clear when you see it. And good design on big infrastructure is absolutely critical because it means that you actually marry all of the constraints together. You make sure you preserve valuable archaeology, you make sure you look out for communities and make sure you don't sever the communities badly by some not particularly thoughtful imposition onto them. But design needs time. It doesn't just happen. It's not just a very fundamental linear process. I need inputs into that. So those would be my four things to respond to the third point, Eleanor.
Thank you very much. And given that I'm sort of the local government representative on the stage, I would actually add a fifth, which is political acumen, because I think that that is actually how you properly engage with the communities and you make sure that you don't just immediately run into the barriers of opposition. And it also is sort of extremely helpful in terms of unlocking the funding and the various funding mechanisms that would need to come into play across the whole of London for some of these infrastructure projects. Chris, having heard the view from Arup, what's the TfL take on this and what's the TfL experience in relation to the impact of big projects and how we could do it better.
Well, I think at TfL we're in kind of a unique position because we're on both sides of the argument. On one hand, we're trying to build very large-scale underground infrastructure. Recently got powers for the Northern Line extension. We're currently building Crossrail. We've got plans to excavate at Bank Station. Work's going on at Victoria Station. So we're building an awful lot. But on the other hand, we're also trying to manage what the impacts of all that construction is up on the ground. So it's almost worth looking at it in two ways. Looking at the threats, the obvious one when you're building it is what's already down there, as Mel and Tim have covered in quite some detail, particularly around the unknown unknowns. Just simply looking at the Northern Line extension, which is only 3.2 kilometres, we came across five or six different pieces of infrastructure that no one actually knew was there. And it was the usual quote we got speaking to UKPN or even Thames Water, which was along the lines of, we know it's down there somewhere, but we don't really know where. So there's an awful lot of work doing that. And then also trying to avoid what is down there and what you know about. One of the benefits of underground travel is that it gets you from A to B very quickly. But the further down you go, or the longer the route you go around something, you swiftly erode those benefits. For instance, if you're going 30, 40 metres down, that's an awful lot of escalators to get back up to surface. So you're losing an awful lot of the benefits. So that's looking at it from the side of constructing things. When we start looking at it the other way, as the manager of the strategic road network, one of the greatest threats underground is actually what comes up. So when we're managing things, there's an awful lot of soil that needs to come up and that needs to be transported. And on a single project, that's probably manageable. We work as hard as we can to get it going by rail or river. But when you start looking at the amount of traffic and generated by the projects that are going on in London, you've got High Speed 2, a large amount of which will be underground in London, Crossrail, potentially Crossrail to Thames Tideway Tunnel, Northern Line extension, Bank Station upgrade, Victoria Station upgrade, possibly a Bakerloo Line extension in the future.
Yes.
I knew I had to throw that in. But that actually creates a big issue on our roads. So whereas one project might be able to be brushed under the carpet, you actually have a continuing and ongoing problem.
Okay. Can I just sort of like pick up a question for each of you from my perspective? Mel, you mentioned about overstation development, and my query about that is, do we do enough future-proofing about what we can put now above stations or above underground excavations, and then what we could do in the future? And I'll highlight that to just sort of like highlight the opportunity for an overstation development at Southwark Station, preferably a very tall, elegant tower to balance off the horrible, blocky TfL Palestra building. But are we doing enough to future-proof what we can do above?
Well, interestingly, Southwark Station was built with an overstation development in mind, but of course it's never happened, and it probably
yet.
Will one day.
Yeah,
but,
not yet.
And it was, I think, the only one on the Jubilee Line extension that was actually built with that in mind, because the others were either underneath existing stations or had other raison d'être. Like there were quite a few bus interchanges at Canada Water, Canning Town, and North Greenwich. So, but yes, Southwark is one. Crossrail, of course, have tried in most cases, because most Crossrail stations are going to have two ticket halls. There's two opportunities at a lot of stations for overstation development. So, a lot of them have been designed to take overstation developments.
Thank you, Tim. You mentioned about maybe the process needs to change. I found that really interesting, both in terms of the impact of these sorts of projects have on communities and when the community sort of like rises up and then actually tries to fight its way through the process, particularly if you look at Thames Water's super sewer development, where I don't think anybody on my side of the fence thinks that Thames Water behaved well in the way that they approached that application. They just weren't prepared. They just knew, in inverted commas, they would be able to ride roughshod through the process. But when you think of the people who live and the schools that are in Chambers Wharf, and they'll have 6 years of round-the-clock disruption, noise, mess, HGVs, for something that once it's done will be completely invisible to them, you can see why it's so important to get that process right. But in a nutshell, what would you change about the process? Would you take it into a totally separate process?
I think there's probably two parts. Sorry, it's a very good challenge again. I say it's an interesting place, and I'm probably not the right person to advise. I've been supervising a PhD in Cambridge University who's looking at the social value of infrastructure, and that's been fascinating. So the PhD researcher has gone out and has spoken to a series of communities who've had infrastructure imposed on them. And these are flooding schemes, so actually the people should have received a benefit, and their community should have received a benefit from the infrastructure that was built. And the professionals were all very, very happy that all the consultation had been done properly, there had been lots of leaflets that had gone out, and they felt that from a textbook point of view, from an EIA point of view, it had been a model of how a consultation should be. 3 years afterwards, talking to all the people in the towns that had been affected, they had the opposite viewpoint. They did not feel well consulted. They didn't feel well involved. There had been a series of sort of concessions made to them, but those concessions, I say, were made for whatever small vocal minority had been pushing over very hard. So the local rugby club got a new field, and things happened which were meant to be for the community, but actually they were for a small number of people who won quite a lot out of the works. And the town itself didn't feel particularly benefiting from this particular flood alleviation scheme. So I think there's a lot more to be done. Equally, I know when I see big projects and I see the people going and doing the EIA, the EIA has become very much sort of a mini industry. It's a process. So data is gathered, it's collected very well, it's presented very well, but I think the actual, there's a stage missing, which is about trying to use that as a design tool. Very often the EIA takes place in parallel to, at best, the design process, rather than as a key input into the design process. I think for big infrastructure especially, the shape of it is not necessarily well defined at the outset. We know we want to maybe improve, we were speaking before about, say, improve public transport access in Camberwell or Old Kent Road or something like that, but the right answer isn't let's build a tube line. It might be let's do something else. Let's understand what the key issues are and then work out how we're going to solve it. I personally believe High Speed 2 is going to be very important for the country. However, I think the way that started, its gestation, it was not helpful in terms of getting communities to accept it. So the solution was, let's build a new shiny railway, oh, and here's some things it might do, rather than the UK's got a very fundamental problem with north-south communication. We need to work out whether people are going to travel more, and the answer is probably yes, because 10, 20 years' time is too soon for people to change utterly how they do things. Should we build more motorways? Should we actually try and upgrade railways, which are really, really painful? What are the cost of these things, of these three or four major options? And then conclude as a nation, here is the right answer, rather than having sort of a series of technocrats saying, here is the answer, and you will accept it, which I think is often how some of these things are certainly perceived by local communities.
Thank you. I think I'll be a tiny bit kinder to Chris. What could the boroughs in London do to engage better with TfL and to help to engage their communities better? Having spent the best part of two or three years punching each other's noses and then now being sort of like new best friends, having resolved the Elephant Castle and the Northern Line issues between ourselves, what can we do to get other people not to engage in that fight but to actually engage with the process?
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to the sort of three words we heard earlier, which is visionary, innovate, and integrate, and particularly that integration, because more and more we need to work together. And there's a history of TfL doing its thing, the boroughs doing its thing, and almost coming together in a conflict. And I think we're getting a lot better, but it's having that integrated approach where we're working together. And I think that very much comes back to the point that Tim was raising around not trying to build infrastructure for infrastructure's sake, because quite often that's the way it comes across. In the history, you had a lot of people with maps and crayons drawing lines. And it's actually about working together with the local authorities to understand where the needs are and develop what the solution should be together. So it's an integrated approach.
Thank you very much.